Nous allons poursuivre avec, je crois, je n'ai pas mon programme ici, mais c'est Aniceto qui va professeur Masferrer, Aniceto Masferrer, de l'Université de Valence. Alors, Aniceto Masferrer devait absolument avoir sa place ici cette journée sur l'histoire comparative du droit, car je dirais presque que c'est un militant de la première heure de l'histoire comparative du droit. Nous avons depuis quelques années, il pourra me dire depuis quand, une association, une société internationale qui spécifiquement travaille sur l'histoire comparative du droit, qui a une revue d'histoire comparative du droit. Donc, ce qui ne veut pas dire qu'on n'ait jamais fait une histoire comparative du droit, mais qui ait vraiment mis cela en exergue. Et à cet égard-là, cet apport méritait d'être honoré, et c'est aussi un très grand plaisir pour cette raison de vous avoir ici aujourd'hui et de vous entendre. Et à nouveau, vous n'allez pas vous restreindre à votre propre tradition juridique, mais vous allez nous offrir une approche comparative où vous allez nous parler aussi bien de la tradition française que de la tradition espagnole. Je vous remercie.
So thank you very much for the presentation, for the kind presentation. I have to say sincerely, I feel honored to be invited to participate in this colloquium, and I feel also, I have to say the truth, I feel a bit ashamed of not being able to give the presentation in French. And I hope they will come, in which I will be able to make the presentation in French, particularly here in this country and this wonderful city of Paris. So I thought there would be less people, and then I had prepared some handouts, but I saw there were more people, then I decided to put some of the materials of the handouts in the PowerPoint document. So here are the handouts, but you will see, if anybody has no handout, it's not a problem, because everything will appear in the pictures. So this is, it may be a bit provocative, this title, asking whether the French codification is a model or is not a model. One would say, well, let's take this for granted, that it is a model. Why are you asking whether it's a model or not? So I think that the presentation, in fact, will revolve around three questions. These are the three questions we'll try to answer. Of course, I will leave some windows open because it's a broad topic. It's a very complex topic. It's a very, I would say, even heat topic. We could discuss a lot. And the first question would be, well, is codification a creation of the civil law tradition? Is codification a civil law technique? We could discuss. I would say, from the beginning, no. It's just a type of codification. It's not just a civil law technique. Of course, we can discuss. Some of you may think, well, we can discuss already this question. I don't like your answer. But as I said, I may be a bit provocative with the questions and even with the answers. So the second question would be, is codification compatible with the common law tradition? Well, I would say, although I am saying what I would say at the end of the presentation, I would say yes, but not perhaps with the French codification, and particularly with the image given by the French codification, given by the French school of the Exegesi. This perspective of the French school of the Exegesi, of the codification, of the French codification, is not compatible with the common law tradition. And the third question, can the French codification be considered as a model for the Western legal tradition, or at least for the civil law tradition? In other words, is the French codification a model for the common law tradition? No, it fails. If that is a model, it fails as a model for the common law tradition. Is the French codification a model for the civil law tradition? I would say it's a model, it's not the model. And it also fails this model in some European jurisdictions. And this will come the second part of my presentation concerning the Spanish case. So we have here a picture containing the structure of the presentation. I will say some words as a way of introduction about the codification as a tool for legal reform, then the French codification as a model, the real extent of its influence between myth and reality. The second part will be the connection, the relationship between codification, how the French codification was presented in the common law world. The third point will be the influence of the French codification in Europe, more particularly the Spanish case. And then here I will talk about this part. Let's leave this for the last. So I will try to not to use more time than I have been given. So it means that 30 minutes, I will try to make in 25 minutes. If it's already time, I will cut, and we can leave some aspects for the discussion, because I don't want to abuse of your patience. So then the first question would be, well, codification. What was the idea of codification? Why codification? Why codification was so attractive? We all know that in the Western legal tradition, no matter in the common law jurisdiction, the civil law jurisdiction, the shape of the law was a bit chaotic. Law was not very accessible. Law was uncertain. Law was hardly accessible. Was not easy to find the proper solution when a case was brought before the judge, and something should be done. Yeah? And that problem was not a problem of the civil law tradition, it was a problem of the whole Western legal tradition and in common law jurisdictions as well. I think we could discuss all these concepts, but I will try, I just selected one paragraph which comes from the common law jurisdiction. You have here a description of the problem of the law, the uncertainty as the worst evil. The uncertainty of the common law has long since become a proverb. As it now stands, not only it is uncertain what the law is, but it is uncertain what it will be when a case gets to the ultimate court. The law is continually fluctuating, and although courts talk much about stare decisis, the only decisions they invariably stick to are those which ought never to have been made and which have nothing but precedent to recommend them. So it's a bit harsh statement, but it reflects somehow the situation of the law, not only in the common law jurisdiction, but also in the civil law jurisdiction. Some authors say in the common law jurisdiction was even worse than in the civil law jurisdiction, but I'm not going to go into detail in that aspect. So then from this perspective, we understand the situation. Why the codification technique was so appealing at that time? So we need to reform the law. And what is a codification? Codification is a technique which enables us to change the law. To change the law in the form and to change the law in the substance. Both things. And France was the first country which achieved this codification, the whole legal system. In a few years, from 1804 to 1811, the whole French legal system was codified. Somehow, that was a model here. That was the first. Yeah? This is the first country in achieving a modern codification. But how was this? Well, we have to summarize three ideas of the French codification. One idea was to achieve legal unification. We know very well France was divided. The North and the South. One legal tradition in the North, another legal tradition in the South. So the French Civil Code united this. After the French Civil Code, there was only one legal private law, one civil code for the whole country. That was an important point. Another important point was to reduce the number of legal sources applicable. So in the legal, we had the distinction in Roman law, the leges and iura. Leges, the imperial constitutions, but the iura are the customs, the judicial decisions, legal doctrine. All this was part, shaped the law, was part of the legal, they were legal sources. Well, the French civil code, the French codification made the decision. The decision was it will be one specific, one source, which will be the most important one, the enacted laws. This idea from Rousseau that the lex, the law is the expression of the general will, so codification, in fact, is a legal tool, is a law, is a kind of law, a kind of enacted law. So then, somehow, codification implied to take away, to suppress all the other, to derogate other legal sources which were so important in the Ancien Régime. So the other idea was the liberal principles, although it has been discussed quite a lot. There is a famous article you already know probably by James Godley with the title The Myth of the Code Civil, explaining some principles that theoretically were constituted a rupture with the past. They were not that rupture if you go. If you go to the history and see how some of the principles, they were present. So, but anyway, these liberal principles, the freedom of contract, the property, the importance of property, and even the principle of full liability. So, well, that's summing up some of the main ideas of the French codification. So this was presented in the common law jurisdictions. And this expression, very interesting expression, codiphobia, was used for the first time, at least as far as I know, by a common lawyer trying to explain the feeling they perceived in the Criminal Law Commission when they were considering the possibility to resort to codification in order to put order to the criminal law system in England. And he said that codiphobia infected both the English government and the lawyers who undermine codification efforts. So even some that was in the 19th century, we can go to the 20th century when codification, even today, is seen or regarded by some common lawyers as a savage lion or dangerous monster threatening the survival of the English law tradition. And here we have a very revealing article with the title, Here Lies the Common Law, Rest in Peace, as a way to say, if we really codify the law in England, and that was referring to the criminal law, public law then, this means this will mean the death of the common law. We will change our legal system drastically, completely. So, you can have here a very interesting paragraph I selected of this the same author, saying that the English civil code will have no resemblance in form to the common law, modeled on continental codes. As you can see, this idea that the code is something which is foreign, which is strange, which does not belong to our legal tradition. So, and it has the, it may have the potential effect of sweeping away the essentials, we could say, of our legal tradition. Well, or even this other opinion, in a very well classical book on codification in the British Empire in America, saying, just I read the last two lines, this idea that in England, it says in the middle, it is a vital practical question, for it means nothing less than the changing of the form of the English law from its present and written nature into the forms of codes more or less similar to those which embody the law of continental countries. So this is the idea. This is the somehow the view of the of some common law traditions about the dangers, the possible dangers of using the codification as a technique to reform, to undertake legal reform in the common law tradition. And although I put some examples of England, I could put from other jurisdictions, although it's true that in England the discussion was but also in the United States, particularly in the civil law tradition, in the province of private law, not in the criminal law. So, well, the question is then to see whether this is true or not. I mean, you may have two questions after this few texts. The question is, why do codes constitute a threat against the common law? This is the first question. Second question, why is codiphobia felt or was felt against French codification and not German or other continental legal traditions? Why the French one? So, as you can see, having read some of these texts, so the codification was regarded as a continental product, which means something which was foreign to the common law system, something strange. So, if a code is a continental product, which may sweep away the common law system, then it might be understandable to be afraid of the first modern continental codification, that is, the French codification, which was the first one. It is not uncommon, the idea that the standard of code is the Continental Napoleonic Civil Code. And consequently, for the English, the model of a code is the code of Napoleon. So it seems to me that it has been said is enough to present the problem. So now I'm going to say what I think about this issue, about whether the French codification may be presented as a model or not in the common law tradition. So, I would say that the classical approach or taxonomy used by comparative lawyers in distinguishing the civil law tradition and the common law tradition has failed in showing that both legal traditions have more similarities than differences. And some of the latter have poisoned the relationship between the common law tradition and the civil law tradition, giving rise to a dichotomy between the common law tradition and the civil law tradition. So what difference are we talking about when I'm using the expression differences? I'm referring to the classical idea or conception whereby, according to some comparative lawyers, civil law tradition is a codified system, and the common law tradition is a non-codified system. I will go further by stating that if codification has been considered a peculiarity of the civil law tradition, somehow incompatible with the common law tradition, the French codification has been presented as the model of the civil law tradition. Leaving aside that, according to my view, the French codification is not the model, such approach has poisoned two scientific discussions. The first discussion, the role of the French codification within the continental legal tradition. It has been presented, this idea, a very classical idea, the European codification, two models. The French model on the one hand, and the German model on the other hand, at the end of the 19th century. So, in the other discussion which has been poisoned is the role of codification within the Western legal tradition. And when I say within the Western legal tradition, I am including the civil law tradition and the common law tradition. Some author, for example, stated that, well, in the civil law tradition, they have a substantive codification of law. But in the common law tradition, they only have a kind of formal codification of law, not real codification of law. Let's take a step further. What should be understood by the expression codification? What do we mean by treating the French codification as a model? A consistent historical analysis of the French codification reveals that one thing is what has been presented as the French model of codification, and another, and quite different, what the French codification was and what the French codification drafters had in mind when preparing the French civil codes or the French civil code draft. Let's give some examples of that. How some common lawyers look at codification. Well, codification, private law should be developed by judges because only they could apply the law knowing the facts of each particular case. So legislators were subject to political individual interests. So no compatibility, codification with the common law tradition. And even more, judicial function dwindles into a mere mechanical application of code's provision. So private law could not be codified, since codification implied the to define legal rules, general or particular, in a written form. And another thing defended by some common lawyers about codification, and then not compatible with the common law system, was to say that the code intended to provide a solution for all future cases. So it constituted a complete code. So codification proponents, even in the context of the common law tradition, never conceived a complete code containing a particular rules for every single case which may arise in the future, or the judicial function as a mechanical application of code's provisions, but judges would apply general rules to particular cases. Let's see this preliminary address of the code drafters, of the drafters of the French civil codes. The last line, forcing all is a goal impossible to attain. The drafters of the French civil code were fully aware that it was not possible to present a code with this aim of being able to present a solution for all the possible cases which might arise in the future. So, all these texts from the preliminary address, one would be mistaken in thinking there could exist a body of laws that would anticipate every possible case, yet be within the grasp of the humble citizen. So one thing is what the drafters of the French civil code said, and another thing was what the common lawyers said about what the French code was exactly, and what was the role and the operation of the code in a civil law jurisdictions. So, the same idea. Many things are therefore left to the authority of custom, to the discussion of the learned men, to the arbitration of judges. So this is a kind of contradiction, we said. So the French codification, the French civil code made a decision. The decision is to give, to grant protagonism to the enacted laws, not the other legal sources. But you can see here in this text, written by the drafters of the French civil code, they recognize that we need more sources, not just the enacted law. So even if you, I remember giving a course in Australia, I came across a book, textbook for the first year student in Australia, and I wrote this note. I thought it was interesting. And it says, this is the thing that the first-year students in Australia, they read. Yeah? Traditionally, case law was considered the most important source of law in our common law legal system. Today, however, legislation has overtaken case law as the most prolific and significant source of law. So, then I think it is not accurate to state that the French codification constitutes the model of the civil law tradition codification. I don't think it's accurate to say that the French codification, even including the German codification, constitutes the model of the civil law tradition codification. Even I would say it is not accurate to say that the French codification constitutes the model of the codification technique or method, as I said at the beginning of my presentation. The French codification constituted the first achievement in codifying the law in a jurisdiction belonging to the Western legal tradition. I think the time has come for legal historians to clarify the concept of codification, which doesn't belong to the civil law tradition, neither constitute a peculiarity of the civil law tradition, being incompatible with the common law tradition. I think that's not true, or at least it's not fully true. Nonetheless, it is not an easy enterprise to present codification as a legal method or technique common to both the civil law tradition and the common law tradition. Why? First of all, because the codification technique, or a code, is, as we said, a legal tool. And theoretically, law is not the main legal source of the common law tradition. Although we just saw this is changing. Legal systems are converging, as we could see in the last picture or text we read. So I do not mean that this distinction has disappeared completely, but both the civil law tradition and the common law traditions are gradually converging in this matter. And the second idea, the second point, is that the main obstacle to overcome is cultural and ideological. Here is a very interesting article I read some years ago about Eva Steiner, Codification in England, the need to move from an ideological to a functional approach, a bridge too far. He said, the almost myopic perception of codification by a number of common lawyers is an ideological enterprise rooted in Napoleonic Europe has greatly contributed to the current circumstances where codification is abeyance. So somehow the problem is not a scientific problem, sometimes the problem is an ideological problem. I know that legal science theoretically discards or rejects this factor or non-rational aspects, but this is just the theory. In practice, lawyers are human beings, rational then, but attached to a specific culture or geographical context. And when a scientific matter has been poisoned by the seed of ideology, to reach an agreement is not easy, and the legal discourse and arguments are more passionate than scientific. So I have to change to go to the other topic because I have only 5 minutes. So then I wanted to say more things about that, but I will just escape that in order to follow the time I've been given. So if that has been a problem in the common law jurisdiction, the impact of the French model or the French codification as a model for the common law tradition, what about in the civil law tradition? So here I will focus exclusively upon the Spanish case. This is the structure. I will be quite fast. In 3-4 minutes, I will try to finish. This is the idea, very interesting idea. Why some comparative lawyers and legal historians regard the Spanish civil code as a failure, as an unsuccessful civil code? Why? What's the reason for that? Because they are taking the French codification as a model. We said at the beginning of the presentation, one of the main ideas for the French codification, now I'm referring to the civil code, or the code civil, the idea that the code brought with it legal unification. This failed in Spain. Can you imagine in France a civil code which would be subsidiary law? That the civil code is going to be applied whether there is no legal rule in other parts of France, that would be inconceivable. That's not. Well, that's the case in Spain. In Spain, there is a civil code, but the civil code is only subsidiary in many parts of the private law. Not in marriage, for example, matrimonial law, but in many other parts of the law, this is a subsidiary law. So this is an interesting thing, and this explains why some comparative lawyers and legal historians, they regard the Spanish civil code as a failure, as an unsuccessful civil code, because they take for granted that the model of the French code, the model of the European code, should be the French codification. And the French codification achieved legal unification. So I have some text here reflecting this idea. Here this author said, it has not proven entirely satisfactory. Why? Because it did not achieve legal unification. Or here, Ken Pennington, talking about the codification in Spain, and is thus not entirely successful compromise, mixture of codified Castilian law and codified foreign law. And in our text, there was a plan to create a unified Spanish private law, stimulated by the impressiveness of the French code, but the resistance of the several provinces was too great. So poor people in Spain, they don't have a real, authentic civil code because they did not achieve legal unification. And that's one of the purposes of codification. If you do not achieve legal unification, you don't have a real code. You have a second-rate code. There, of course, this is connected with the idea of the subsidiarity character of the code. Precisely, it did not achieve legal unity because it has a subsidiary character, the Spanish Civil Code. And I have certain several texts reflecting or showing this idea of incompleteness of the Spanish Civil Code because it is a subsidiary law. So, and the other idea, which reminds me that somehow it's difficult to say that the Spanish Civil Code followed in the French Civil Code footsteps, is the idea of the legal sources. Not only the idea of the operation of the codes or the role of the codes, but the idea, what are the main legal sources? So if you compare the French Civil Code with the Spanish Civil Code, you see that the French Civil Code did not recognize explicitly the custom as a legal source. The customs, can you see references to the custom in different articles of the French Civil Code? But there is no explicit recognition of the customary law as a formal legal source in the French Civil Code. That was completely different in Spain. In Spain, we had the custom, of course, the general principles of law, but that's the same thing like the French law. And the other thing, it was, and this is the final thing, is the judicial precedent. Can you imagine in the French Civil Code giving binding force to the judicial precedent? Well, in Spain, well, although you have here a preliminary address saying, the drafters, that it was very important, the judicial precedent. But anyway, in fact, it did not go to the text of the French Civil Code. In Spain, we had in 1895, a Spanish Civil Code project reform. Look at these three articles. First article mentioned the enacted law, the custom, and the jurisprudencia, case law, as legal sources. Article 3, after referring to the enacted law and the custom and the general principles of law, mentioned the jurisprudencia exactly applicable to the case. That was, the reason for that was the weight, the importance, the protagonism of judicial precedent in the Spanish legal traditions. And the final consideration I had, I will finish here. So French codification and codiphobia in the common law tradition. I would select one statement from Kurtz. Do not take code so seriously. But then let's see the relationship between the French Civil Code and the Spanish Civil Code within the civil law tradition. I would say the opposite. Take particularities and differences more seriously, as it was said in the conference given by Alain in his chair in this College of France this year. So we have to take particularities more seriously. So how to explain such paradox? Why I can say two different opposite things in two different cases? How to explain such paradox? I would say law is partly a product of culture. And culture contains tensions, deep feelings, passions, contradictions. Thank you very much.
Merci beaucoup, Aniceto, pour cette communication qui... Alors, d'une part, il y a un paradoxe dans le sujet qu'il a représenté. D'une part, on peut avoir l'impression qu'il s'agit d'une discussion presque d'une autre époque. On dit, ah oui, mais... on ne pense plus dans ces termes-là du code civil, on pense aux discussions, on pense à toutes les espérances qu'il y a pu avoir, toutes les attentes qu'il y a pu avoir au XIXe siècle de ce code civil, tout le mythe qui a été construit autour du code civil, c'est quand même d'une autre époque. Alors ce n'est pas tout à fait vrai quand même. Je me souviens, pendant ma propre période professionnelle, on a quand même connu tout un engouement, et notamment chez beaucoup de juristes, il y a eu beaucoup d'encre qui a coulé sur l'idée d'un code civil européen. Idée, bon, je l'ai déjà critiqué dans la leçon inaugurale, parce que on a souvent conçu un code civil européen comme un instrument du même type qu'on a parfois conçu les codes nationaux comme instrument de la construction, de la formation de l'État-nation. Alors ça, c'est évidemment très dangereux, parce que si on transpose ça au niveau européen, c'est comme si on concevait l'intégration européenne comme la construction d'un nouvel État-nation, ce qui ne peut certainement pas être, je crois, très réaliste. Au-delà de cette conception-là, mais donc ça montre aussi un peu l'actualité de la question. Au-delà de cette question de code et de sa portée politique, il y a quand même aussi la question de savoir à quel type de... je reviens sur la notion de culture juridique, un code est lié, parce que justement, si depuis une quinzaine, vingtaine d'années, et notamment en droit comparé, la notion de culture juridique est venue à l'avant-plan. J'avoue que quand moi j'étais étudiant, les premières années que j'étais assistant ou professeur, on ne parlait pas tellement de culture juridique, cette notion. Alors, cette notion est revenue à l'avant-plan et je crois que justement, on pourrait dire l'avancement et puis un peu le déclin de l'idée d'une codification européenne a joué un rôle. En ce sens qu'on s'est rendu compte que même si on devait avoir, on a eu des avant-projets, on a eu des projets d'un code civil européen, que même si on avait pu introduire un tel code, un code civil européen qui était quand même beaucoup plus restreint quant aux matières que la plupart des codes traditionnels, que même si on avait eu un tel code, on n'avait aucune garantie qu'un tel code soit appliqué, soit compris par les juges, par les juristes académiques, dans la doctrine, dans les pays aussi différents que la Finlande, le Portugal, l'Italie, l'Angleterre, l'Irlande, et ainsi de suite. Donc, c'est à ce moment-là, j'ai eu l'impression qu'on s'est rendu compte que parce qu'il y avait des cultures juridiques nationales qui différaient tellement que les types de raisonnement, les types de formation de juristes, formation aussi bien à l'université que dans le cadre professionnel, dans le monde judiciaire ou ailleurs, différaient encore tellement d'un pays à l'autre que même la matrice d'un code unique et uniforme ne remplissait pas encore toutes les conditions qu'il fallait pour en assurer véritablement ce qu'on en espérait, c'est-à-dire un degré beaucoup plus grand d'harmonisation, d'uniformisation du droit. C'est toute la question de savoir quel est en fait le rôle de ce qu'on appelle les sources du droit. Il ne faut jamais oublier que les sources du droit, c'est finalement que des produits d'acteurs politiques et sociaux. N'oublions pas que s'il est parfaitement concevable, comme on le sait, dans un ordre juridique, d'avoir une jurisprudence, d'avoir une doctrine sans législation, en revanche, il est inconcevable, en fait, d'avoir une législation sans une doctrine, sans une jurisprudence. Donc, les types de raisonnement, les types d'argumentation, quand est-ce qu'on devient un juriste dans un certain système, c'est pas en lisant de la législation, c'est pas en ayant de la législation. On ne comprend un système juridique qu'à force de lire, d'étudier, et ça prend un certain temps, de se familiariser avec les modes de raisonnement. Et où est-ce qu'on les trouve? On les trouve dans la pratique, par exemple dans les jugements, on les trouve à travers la doctrine. C'est la seule manière, ce n'est pas en lisant la législation, ce n'est pas en lisant un code d'un pays qu'on apprend quel est le droit de ce pays. Il faut passer par notamment ces autres sources, et notamment les sources des juristes, pour comprendre comment ça se comprend. Donc ça c'est une question de grand débat, et qui donc, j'insiste là-dessus, je trouve très utile aussi pour l'objet d'aujourd'hui.